Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, community radio by and for the people. Broadcasting at 104.5 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WRFU.net. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers who don't necessarily represent the views of WRFU, the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, or the Urbana Socialist Forum. So you're welcome. We want to welcome you to another edition of the World Labor Hour on Corporate Free Community Radio, and we're broadcasting from downtown Urbana, Illinois, and we've got a special guest here live in the studio, Dave Beck, who's the AsME union representative for Central Illinois. Dave, welcome to the World Labor Hour.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, so there's been a lot going on, seems like this week, with AsME workers in the state of Illinois. There was some various protest rallies around the state and everything. You want to let the listeners know kind of what the background is on this and kind of maybe what's going on currently and where it might be heading?
Yeah, sure. Just shut me up if I go on too long.
Okay.
We've been in negotiations for the 38,000 so state employees that we represent. We're in those negotiations with the governor and the governor's people. We started in February of 2015. Contract expired later that year. And in January of this year, the governor walked out of negotiations, essentially in the middle. This is a complex contract. It takes a long time to negotiate, and he walked out right in the middle and said that he was done and that he believed that the negotiations were at impasse. He then went to the labor board, state labor board, and requested that they declare that we're at impasse. And the purpose of that is so that he could then impose what's called his last best final offer. That last best final offer is a doozy. It includes a doubling of health insurance costs, what we estimate to be about $3,000 per the average AFSCME member a year. Coupled with that is a four-year wage freeze, some crazy merit bonus scheme that he has, a way that he could give bonuses to the people he likes and the people that support him. It also includes an unfettered ability to privatize, so that he could let our people go and replace them with people working minimum wage who know nothing about the jobs they're doing. And the list goes on and on. So he went to the labor board. We had about a six-week hearing, and the administrative law judge back in August of this year ruled that we're at impasse on some things and not at impasse on the more crucial issues such as wages and health insurance. That was a weird enough ruling. I've never seen a split decision like that, but still, she did rule that we're not at impasse on the most important issues. Well, that's not really a decision. It's just a recommendation that she then gives to the labor board. Labor board ruled then on Tuesday, and I should add that the labor board is appointed by the governor. The labor board ruled on Tuesday that we are at impasse. And their decision was even crazier because first they ignored their administrative law judge's recommendation and instead took one portion of her recommendation, which said we were at impasse on one issue, and said, well, since you're at impasse on one issue, you're at impasse entirely, which makes no sense. I know not everyone is used to negotiations, especially complex negotiations, but you can't be at impasse on one issue because at any day, one side could say, okay, we'll give in on that issue if you give us X or Y or Z. Therefore, proving you're not at impasse, because then the other side could say, okay, we'll take it. But that's what they ruled, gave him what he wanted. They gave the governor what he wanted. And so now he is already moving to impose his last best final offer. He sent an email out to all of our members a couple of days ago saying, he's going to start imposing portions of the last best final offer. So now we're a little bit in a holding pattern. The labor board has to issue their written decision, which we expect sometime this week, and at which point we will appeal it to the courts and also ask the courts for injunctive relief, meaning, don't let the governor impose until the ruling is made on the appeal. So, you know, we'll do that, and then we'll see what the courts say. You know, meanwhile, our members are obviously very upset, very scared, angry. You know, there's lots of discussion on whether what our next step should be and whether or not our members should strike. And you know, of course, that's the question of the day. Everybody wants to know, are you going to strike? And of course, that's not a decision I can make or any of the leadership can make. It's a decision of the members. And you know, we'll be having lots and lots of discussions as we have been having, and we'll at some point likely we'll have to have a vote to say, hey, are you willing to accept this, or are you going to strike to get, you know, to get your rights and benefits that you deserve? So we'll see.
Okay, so can you let the listeners know kind of your members do as far as around the state of Illinois? Of course, many of them work at the state universities. What other kind of state facilities and occupations do they work in?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's somewhat complicated because the contract we're talking about is for the vast majority of the employees that work underneath the governor or the executive branch. Children and Family Services, Human Services, unemployment, Healthcare and Family Services, which often is called Child Support, Natural Resources, et cetera, et cetera. But while we're negotiating all the terms and conditions of employment for those folks, which is about 38,000, and I should add that includes corrections as well, so about 38,000 employees that we're directly representing through these negotiations, we're also negotiating the health insurance that becomes the entire state employee health insurance plan. So although we're only directly negotiating for these 38,000 employees, we're negotiating health insurance that is then applied to, I'm not sure what the number is, but it's got to be, you know, over 100,000 state employees. And anyone that works for a university, anyone that works at all for the state, that gets the state employee health insurance plan, we're negotiating that for them. So, you know, the professors out there, the university president, his insurance plan is the plan that we negotiate. So, you know, not only are our state employee members, you know, lives at stake here, but every university employee, if your insurance is doubled next week or, you know, the week after that or whatever, what impact is that going to have on you? And, you know, we have members that we also represent at the university that make as little as $10 an hour. And, you know, if their insurance doubles, what are they going to do? You know, to talk a little more about what our members do for, you know, for the state. I mean, they literally keep the state running. You know, almost every service that you can imagine here in Illinois, protecting kids, you know, the Children and Family Services, our investigators go out and they investigate abuse and neglect. You know, unemployment office, you know, how many of our residents and citizens depend on that when they're hard up and they lose their job? Mm-hmm. Child support, you know, they make sure that that the kids and the families get the child support that they need to survive. Natural resources, all of our parks, you know, they keep our parks running. Corrections, you know, they make sure that the inmates are safe and that the citizens are safe. You know, the list can, I could talk forever about what they do. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure you don't want me to do that. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's really crucial work. And oftentimes for many of us, it's in the background. And I shudder to think what, you know, if a strike were to happen and the state were to shut down, it's not going to be in the background anymore. People are going to see the impact that these folks have on a daily basis to how our society functions. And, you know, that's not something our members want. You know, they do not want to shut down government. They want to do their jobs. They love doing their jobs. But if they're forced.
Most of the time anyway.
Yeah, right, sure, right. you know, it's not always great, yeah. But they wouldn't do it, you know, if they didn't want to do it. And, you know, I talk to them all the time, and they're so heavily invested in what they do. And, you know, I think, frankly, that's why there hasn't been a strike yet, because our members have told us time and again they want us to do everything that we can do to prevent this from happening, because they want to do their jobs. And, you know, it's scary to think what would happen if they were forced to go on strike.
Well, it is a very scary scenario. You know, all labor organizations, workers, they have to sometimes face that particular scenario. But one of the things that we've seen these past couple of years, going back to probably mid-2015, is that the rise in labor militancy across the country has really led to some really progressive changes in different sectors of labor. A lot of workers, particularly, are starting to feel a lot more support from other sectors of labor when they go on strike now, because there's been so many strikes and so many even strike authorization votes that don't reach actual strikes. So there's something in the air amongst workers, into where they're starting to identify themselves now as being more militant than before, and understanding that there is a support system amongst various labor organizations and individual workers for striking workers. So the support is going to be there if it does get to that point.
Dave, right before the program, you told me that AFSCME Union and State of Illinois did a some polling survey not too long ago.
Yeah, I mean,
it's the general public.
The general public, and it's pretty clear that the public supports public employees. There's also, you know, there's often a narrative that that citizens don't support public employees, that they think they're lazy or whatever. But that's not what we've seen. When we talk to people, we hear a lot of support from the public, and I think that, you know, that's been borne out. If you remember the CTU strike, the Chicago Teachers Union
yep.
strike, you know, just what Gus was saying, the amount of support for that union from the public and mm-hmm. from other unions was phenomenal, and. You know, they were able to shut down all the schools in Chicago and get what they deserved. And, you know, they couldn't have done that without that level of support from the public and other unions. And
yeah, in particular, I understand they had parents and students coming out, walking with them on the picket lines.
Neighborhood organizations as well.
And we saw the same thing a few years ago. Our members that work for the Will County, which is, you know, the county, sort of a suburbs of Chicago, Joliet, that sort of area. They were on a strike and had tremendous support. I mean, some of those folks work in nursing homes and things that the county runs, and the that's a tough decision to make, you know, when you're taking care of residents like that. And the residents were so supportive, and their families were so supportive. I don't think it could have been successful without that support.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know. I mean, because I don't know. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like ever since Governor Rauner got elected, which, by the way, was because of a great dissatisfaction with the previous Democratic governor and his new running mate, Paul Vallis, who was the charter school king. So Rauner didn't get elected because of people. I mean, basically because of the hatred for the policies of more recent Governor Quinn. But it seems like ever since Republican Governor Bruce Rauner has been elected, it seems like he's been actually trying to provoke a fight with public sector workers. Would you say that's true or not?
Yeah. I mean, definitely. Absolutely. Before he was elected, it was part of his campaign. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had no doubt that this is what he wanted to do. You know, there's plenty of video footage of him saying during his campaign that he wanted to shut down government, that a strike was necessary. And he's also talked about driving a wedge in the Democratic Party between the union support for the Democratic Party and the sort of community-based support. And that ties into the budget, right? He's kept the budget hostage in order to get anti-union, anti-worker legislation passed. He's been very clear that his goal is to drive a wedge between the community groups that are not getting funding and the union groups.
Exactly.
It isn't working. It's clearly not working because community groups understand the value of unions and labor, and the labor obviously understands the value of the community groups and the social services. I think as long as we stand together, you know, we'll get a budget, we'll get a contract, and the governor will go home. And, you know, he's got to get bored by this, I think, eventually, because
you have more faith than that. Yeah. I'm telling you, this Rauner guy, he's clearly trying to break the state of Illinois into pieces, particularly the city of Chicago and what he's doing with the, you know, trying to turn it into another Detroit scenario where they come in and take over the entire city. And the thing about Rauner is, like you said, Dave, that the minute he started campaigning, his campaign was solely about division and breaking apart people, keeping everything separate. And when his turnaround agenda kept getting thrown away by multiple groups and regions in the state of Illinois, that's when he doubled down on, okay, now it's time to really destroy the state of Illinois. Because they, like you said, community groups and unions and other organizations refuse to embrace that turnaround agenda. So his oppression just got so much worse because he knew that there was going to be a big resistance to him.
Yeah, he's obviously very determined, and you know, unlike in the past, I think he's got the money to keep pushing. And so we saw that in this past election, the millions and millions of his own dollars that he put into various campaigns all over the state. You know, and he's going to use that. He's going to use that against us as well. And he's going to use it in 2 years when he's running for reelection. And you know, but we've got, you know, we've got something he doesn't have, and that's the people power. And so, yeah, I am hopeful because you know he can keep spending his money, you know, we've got the people on the ground. We've got the hearts and souls. So.
Okay, Dave, well, thank you so much for coming in today and talking about this, and I'm sure, we'll be in contact here probably, you know, in the near future and stuff, because it seems like this is just getting heated up, and, you know, so, yes, thank you so much, and whatever we can do to help out, to publicize whatever, let us know.
And if I could, I just want to, you know, urge people, you know, call your legislator and tell them that you want them to put pressure on the governor. You know, here in town, we've got great support from Senator Bennett and from Representative Ammons. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, you get outside of those borders and the support diminishes. So, you know, call them. The number to the sort of general number to call is 1-888-912-5959. You call that number 1-888-912-5959, and they can put you in touch with your legislator and tell them to put pressure on the governor, and you know, we'll go from there.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dave. And you're listening to the World Labor Hour, supported community radio station WRFU. We're going to take a quick music break here, and we'll be right back.
All crazy, Uncle Sam is madder than a hatter. But
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on the supported community radio station WRFU, broadcasting at 104.5 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WRFU.net. We got another guest who's calling into the show at about 12 noon, Sean O'Terrain, Irish activist and author. He'll be calling in from Chicago to discuss his book, The Donegal Woman. And in the meantime, we've got some public service announcements here. How to be a supporter for the undocumented community. It's Wednesday, November 30th, 6:30 to 8 at the Champaign Public Library, 200 West Green Street in Champaign. Join the CU Immigration Project and La Línea Community Helpline for an Ask an Immigrant panel discussion and training on how to be a supporter for the undocumented community in Champaign and Urbana. And just to let you know, also this is from the Green National Green Party. When you look under the hood of the last election, you find a lot of new Greens powering our local governments. Overall, the Green Party emerged victorious in races across 8 different states. Greens won their races and were elected to many different kinds of positions, everything from the Soil and Water Conservation Board and to Park Commissioner and all sorts of other local offices, and including one of the more exciting victories, the re-election of Bruce Carlos Delgado, who's really elected the mayor of Marina, California, on election night. He's been the mayor of Marina since 2008, and also another city that has a majority on city council that's Greens is Richmond, California. So anyway, they're saying here that that what Greens do when you get elected is a lot of good. And at the end of this letter, you'll find, they're going on to say the Green Party activists are already hitting the ground running by organizing, calling for actions against harmful policies, as well as much-needed reforms of the political system. I also understand that, in kind of conjunction with that, that there was a huge protest would be the right word, but basically a whole bunch of people descended on the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee last week.
Oh, good.
Basically, we're just like, it was almost came to a sit-in. Didn't quite happen to call the police and stuff, but I think that's what they were pushing for. But, this is basically what I think we're going to see a lot more of, is basically the people, the real people, so to speak, are going to be basically doing whatever they have to do to try to get back, some sense of, the democracy and the protection of their, standard of living in the environment in general that we live in. Okay, Labor's Worldview TV, they're sending every Sunday from 4 to 5 on Comcast Channel 6 and live at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. And this week, this Sunday, is Harry Bridges and the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union's History. Really good documentary was done about 10, 15 years ago when Harry Bridges was still alive. Part of it interviews with him, but also a lot of old film footage from the 1930s showing the actual film confrontations of the police for the San Francisco general strike. And also, let's see, on Tuesday on UPTV is November 22nd at 7 p.m. is the broadcast, the annual broadcast of the Nigel Turner film, The Men Who Killed Kennedy. And today and every Saturday from 2 to 3 on WRFU is done in our sports show, Radical Look at Sports with fellow worker Neil Parthen. And also on WRFU every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. Tune in for the People's History Hour with hosts Nick and Neil. That's all here at WRFU 104.5 and live worldwide at WRFU.net. So, okay, Gus, well, I guess there's a lot going on around the country, and let's hear what kind of caught your attention this week.
You know, the thing is that it's been over a week since the election. And what's really caught my attention is that more and more of the Democrats, the liberals, are now pushing this agenda. You know, let's not forget the biggest part of the campaign for the Democrats was the Anything But Trump campaign. You remember
that?
That's what they kept saying over and over again. That was Hillary Clinton's discourse for most of the election. Anything is better than Trump. Now, a week after the election, the Democrats are pushing new discourse, saying, "Let's give it a chance. Let's work with Donald Trump. Let's give it a chance, and let's reform the Democratic Party to get stronger through working with Trump." That's what you hear. Like, give him a chance. You're hearing all this stuff, but Donald Trump continues to prove over and over again that he is willing to put in the power a white supremacist, neoliberal government structure. I mean, it is right in the cabinet selections. I told you this, Dave, the first time that I lost interest in President Obama was when I saw his cabinet picks. When you see who a president picks for their cabinet positions, it lets you know the type of statement they are making, not only to the country, but also to the rest of the world. So Trump picked his first few cabinet people this week. And if you and if you're anybody that understands the severity of Trump's election, then you understand that this is now a serious crisis mode when you look at the people that he selected on Friday.
Unbelievable.
The three appointments: Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama for Attorney General, retired General Michael Flynn for National Security Advisor, and Representative Mike Pompeo for CIA Director. They underscored the ultra-right, militaristic, and anti-democratic character of this new administration. Remember, these are, and then here's the thing, this is not a Republican party, this is not a Republican administration. These are a bunch of white, right-wing, white supremacists who have hijacked the Republican Party to put forth a fascist government. Trump has been encouraged by the response by the Democratic Party to the election to press forward with his right-wing agenda, confident that he will encounter no significant political opposition. In the 10 days since the election, leading Democrats have come out to wish Trump well and pledge to work with him in implementing key elements of his nationalist, white nationalist policy. This is the part that people, and here's the thing, we have to be able to take this moment and understand it, analyze it, and use it to better our condition. We cannot allow the Democratic Party to be a sustainable party anymore. This past week has shown us that not only do the Democratic Party neglect the working people, but they are also in bed with instituting fascist policies. Everything Donald Trump has done and the people he selected has shown that he wants to run a fascist white supremacist government structure that takes away the resources of working people. And the Democrats have done nothing but say, support him.
Yeah.
That's why we have to use this moment to understand that this two-party system is nothing but an oppressive structure that allows the political economy to continue to be an unequal and oppressive system. We have to use this. Let's be clear. Trump's election of Stephen Bannon, the former head of Breitbart News, which has direct ties to fascist and white supremacist organizations. You Google Stephen Bannon's name, the first thing that comes up is his ties to alt-right and other white supremacist groups. You Google Jeff Sessions' name, and everything comes up about his love for the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, Jeff Sessions has been around for a long time. He's got a very verifiable, horrible track record.
He has went on record saying he hates groups that support civil rights. And he has an admiration for the Ku Klux Klan until he found out that some of their members smoke marijuana.
Are you kidding?
But everything else was proved up. These are statements that he has made clearly and has never backtracked on them at all. So again, for Attorney General, Sessions as Attorney General, who was going to supervise both the FBI and the Civil Rights Division of Justice Department. So you have somebody who's anti-civil rights over the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. People, listen, you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah.
He is one of the most extreme right-wing people, and his nomination as a federal judge was rejected by his own political party-controlled Senate 30 years ago because they said he was too racist. Seriously?
Yeah.
A racist public political party rejected somebody because they felt that he was too much of an extreme racist. That's how serious this session is. Putting this person in control over law and order over this country, this should be a human rights crisis, a direct threat to the livelihood of people in this country, majority black and brown people. We are now going to be targets. That's what Trump is saying when he picked this cabinet, that I am making a statement. I am not going to work with anybody else. I have an agenda to bring law and order, to reemerge a social hierarchy that keeps black and brown people in the lowest segment of the population. I mean, I cannot believe that there's not more outrage. I'm still seeing these marches and these protests about the anti-Trump stuff, but I don't see anything about Sessions and Bannon. You got a couple of letters going out saying, well, yeah, you should take away Bannon's, your nomination for Bannon, et cetera. There's a couple of things here and there, but there's nothing outright. There's no outright anger
at putting these people in power. That's what's so scary now.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, yeah.
You talked last week about what you think is the need for us in different communities to start getting organized and stuff.
I mean,
and you gave the example of the Black Panther Party about what they had to do.
Listen, I'm gonna be very blunt honest here. I was saying that stuff in terms of network community organizing
yes,
stuff.
Yes.
But when I saw these particular cabinet nominations, we have to really start looking at self-defense groups. We have to literally start talking to our neighborhoods, our communities, about learning self-defense tactics to survive and protect ourselves. Because this is going to be a, for lack of a better term, a blitzkrieg
yeah.
on the people of this country.
Yeah.
Sessions has been clearly stated that he believed, matter of fact, Sessions was the only person to always support Donald Trump through all the horrible things he said and all the things that came out about his past, even the child molestation charges. He was the only one to stay in his corner. And he said he believed in everything about registering Muslims. And there's talk about internment camps for Muslims. He supported him through that as well. So again, we have somebody that has a virtual hatred for Black and brown people. Not that they don't matter to him, but he wants to see them oppressed.
Yeah.
That's what we need to talk about.
Yeah, and I mean, if he goes through with all this stuff, I mean, this cabinet says everything. I mean, and I think we're entering some very rough and interesting times coming up here, but like you said, Gus, we need to be prepared.
Again, people think that, you know, they say that because I'm a big leftist, that I use too much hyperbole. But let me give you some more history on Sessions.
Okay.
Sessions was 18 at the time of the famous Civil Rights March in Selma, Alabama, where he was born. He graduated from college in 69 and then the University of Alabama Law School. He joined the U.S. Attorney's Office in Mobile. In 1981, Ronald Reagan named him U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Alabama. So you know where this is going. During that period that he was U.S. Attorney for Southern District of Alabama, he carried out this huge, and everybody knows about this, huge witch hunt prosecution of three veteran civil rights workers, Albert and Evelyn Turner and Spencer Polk, charging them with vote fraud under a section of the Voting Rights Act because of their efforts to register elderly rural Black voters. The three were brought to trial, but a racially mixed jury unanimously acquitted them of all charges after deliberating only 3 hours. 4 months after this legal farce, Reagan nominated Sessions to fill a vacant position on the U.S. District Court. Four co-workers of Sessions from the Justice Department testified to his racist comments, ranging from loving the Ku Klux Klan, and listeners, I am not making this up, that he would tell his other people that worked around him how much he loved the Ku Klux Klan, to calling a Black attorney boy during an office discussion. Sessions admitted to describing both the NAACP and the ACLU as un-American and communist. The political uproar was so strong that a Republican-controlled Senate ultimately refused to bring his nomination to the floor of the Senate for a vote. So while denied a judgeship, Sessions continued as U.S. attorney and built a political career on the alleged snub, which became a cause for celebration for Southern races. He ran for Alabama State's attorney in 94 and won, then ran for a vacant U.S. Senate seat in 96, winning first the Republican primary, then the general election. He has been reelected three times in his last campaign in 2014, running unopposed without even the token Democratic challenger. So Sessions has been one of the most consistently reactionary figures in U.S. Senate, particularly in relation to immigration. Now, this is big. Now, this is why people saying that Trump chose him for this position. He once told the publication Roll Call that nativist was a perfectly acceptable description of his viewpoint. Now, for those who don't know history, the nativist groups were the Ku Klux Klan, the White National League, nativist groups, and they were proud. They believed that white men are the native rulers of the U.S.
This goes back historically to the Know Nothing Party.
Yes, the Know Nothing Party. This goes back into the early
what an appropriate name.
Yeah, these were the groups that were going around killing and assassinating Black people, assassinating Chinese immigrants working on railroads, and then they're the ones that ushered in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 that pushed that barred Chinese workers from coming to the country, and they also worked to bar other immigrants
yes.
from coming to the country as well. So the nativist party it hates everybody that's not a white male. Mm-hmm. So he said, that's who I am. And that's what that word means. There is no, this nativist has five or six different meanings. No. In American history, nativist means white supremacy. Plain and simple. And this is what he wants to do. His hardline opposition to both legal and illegal immigration was apparently the basis for why he was attracted to what Trump said about barring Muslims and registering them, et cetera. So this is what we're faced with right now. The question is, what do we do? Because this is only the first three of the cabinet nominations, and they've all been just so far away from ensuring any type of civil liberties and proving to us, like I said last week on the show, that for the first time in decades, we don't have the federal government to actually be something of a support. You know, the federal government has never been a full supporter of workers' rights, et cetera, but there's always been something there because we had the 1938 Labor Act. National Labor Relations Act.
Yes.
You know, we had things like that. We had, unemployment. We had, you know, things that help out people who are in trouble. So there's a segment of the federal government there. That's going to be gone soon.
Yeah.
This cabinet selection is proof point that that's going to be gone soon. And then you have the other group who's supposedly be supporting workers, the Democratic Party, actually supporting Trump's nominations and telling them to give him a chance.
Yeah, because they have nothing to worry about.
Yeah, of course they don't have that, because they're not going to be affected by what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Most of these liberals are mostly petty bourgeoisie who don't live in working class and poor neighborhoods. So they're not going to have an issue with this stuff.
Yeah.
They're not going to have an issue with military occupying and the increased 300% increase of police forces just surveilling streets all over the place. They don't have a problem with jobs being usurped and moved into areas that are non-union. So that means the wages are plummeting. I mean, they don't have to worry about those things.
Yeah, Paul Street wrote a really interesting article on this recently called Beyond the Hollow Ones. He describes the Democratic leadership as the hollow ones, you know. And he basically starts out by saying the elitist corporate Democrats prefer to hand presidential and Supreme Court tipping power over to a quasi-proto-neo or real fascist than to be a social democratic party of the people. Mm-hmm. It's all about the corporate agenda, don't forget my commentary. That much is clear from their insistence on running a hopelessly corrupt, politically incompetent, and uninspiring right-wing corporate Democrat named Hillary Clinton against Donald Trump. You know, for all of his serious flaws from a seriously left perspective, Bernie Sanders might well have been able to leap past the usual right-wing vote tampering in key electoral college states to defeat Trump. Sanders would have had a much better chance of winning the election over Trump because he didn't share the neoliberal Clinton Democrats' contempt for the working class and rural people. The heartland people, Mrs. Clinton foolishly smeared him as deplorables.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah. And, you know, he goes on to say, Sanders ran in accord with the majority progressive opinion on numerous key policy issues. For that, he was treated with the standard disdain elite dollar Democrats have long held for progressives in their party's ranks. The Robert Rubin Clinton Obama Citibank Council on Foreign Relations Democrats scorn for their party's left wing is written all over WikiLeaks and numerous other sources, including the editorial pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post. See, I mean, this is the thing I'm kind of surprised, Gus, that there aren't more people out there saying, you know, trying to claim that Hillary Clinton was our savior. And in fact, I heard that actually there has been some in the media, like Rachel Maddow is basically saying, because you people deserve this because you didn't support Hillary Clinton, our savior.
No, I'm saying, though, there's actually been stories out there that Hillary has received flowers. She's received video camera footage of videos taken from her supporters crying. Mm-hmm. So she's gotten all this fan mail and these flowers and gifts from her supporters, and like we know, so she is being looked upon as this savior. And they're also doing this thing to where, because she did win the popular vote, that she is now a victim of democracy now. Mm-hmm. And and that's why this whole thing about abolishing the Electoral College now all of a sudden,
which should be done for
Of course it should be done, but it should have been done. It should have been done before it was even enacted. So, the thing about the Democrats, let me give you some quotes, listeners, from the Democratic Party and how they are. And this is after Trump's selections of these people. Newly elected Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer said that the Senate Democrats were, quote, ready to stand shoulder to shoulder with Republicans, working with soon-to-be President Trump on issues where we agree, end quote. Vice President Joe Biden gave the incoming administration his full support, telling reporters after meeting with Vice President-elect Mike Pence that he's, quote, confident on day one everything will be in good hands,
yeah,
end quote. Hillary Clinton, in her first public appearance since her concession speech last week, spoke for 20 minutes at a conference of the Children's Defense Fund without mentioning either Trump or the mass protest against him. At the same time, a section of the Democratic Party leadership is making criticisms of Trump in an attempt to restore the shattered credibility of the Democratic Party and contain the growth of social opposition. In other words, they're trying to take those protests and trying to turn them into Democratic,
yes,
Party people,
yes,
instead of actually keeping them grassroots, you know, like trying to build something outside the political system.
Yeah, they say that they're going to try to get Keith Ellison elected as head of the DNC.
Yep.
But who, guess who they want to make head of the minority leader in the House?
Yeah.
Chuck Schumer. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That man is, next to Hillary Clinton, is the second most poster child for a corporate Democrat.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, so here's what they're doing. They're going to try to deceive, distract, and try to, you know, wiggle their way, out of this, basically. Try to prevent any kind of grassroots popular uprising, or take over of the Democratic Party.
And this has to be the political education that is being spoken at in town halls across,
yes,
countries, in different community organizations. They have to understand that the federal government will no longer be viable. The Democratic Party has shown that they are not viable and don't have the interests of us. Then you have the vigilantism and the other groups. I mean, I could do a whole show on the uptick in hate crimes,
yes,
that have happened since the election. So you got all these different factors that have put working class people on an island.
Yes.
Like, we're by ourselves in this fight. And that's what we're going to have to depend on each other to build our communities and support each,
yes,
other.
Yes, because they're going to try their darnest to divide us.
You know? They're going to keep the, yeah, especially now with this thing with the, especially what happened if the so-called NAFTA agreement is a abolished,
yeah,
if TPP is killed, you know, and then, like I said, there's going to be, they're not in office because they're stupid. They understand that there are ways to divide the working classes and keep this hierarchy, this psychological and material wage, where white workers are placed in a pedestal higher than black workers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to continue to exploit that. That's why I sent this great article on Facebook a couple of days ago, and a lot of people don't recognize this because it is crack.com.
Yes.
And crack.com, it was known about 2 decades ago for being a purely humor magazine.
Yes.
That's all they did. But since then, they actually employ real researchers, sociologists, historians, business people to actually do research. And they put out this amazing article about how Trump's campaign is actually fascist. Because you've heard a lot of Democrats say, oh, Trump's not fascist yet. He's not fascist yet. But if you read that article from crack.com, it actually shows the trajectory of when Hitler was running,
yeah,
for chancellor, and when Trump was running, and how they did things very similarly.
Yeah.
Because what you have, what's the first thing that Trump did when he heard about the hate crimes going out? He told people to stop the hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to quell the most extreme of the hate crimes so that he gets some more public support for what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler did the same thing. He didn't come in at the very beginning and saying, kill everybody.
Right.
You know, he didn't come in saying, let's put them in concentration camps and in the ghettos. He didn't say that at first. He actually took out most of the extreme anti-Semitic people and put them in prisons.
Yeah.
And that garnered a lot of support for him so he could start in putting in policies that slowly took away the rights of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Trump is doing, but except Trump is going further than Hitler did. He's actually putting in real hardcore white supremacists, mm-hmm, like Sessions. That one is the one that stung the most.
Oh, yeah.
That one,
yeah.
I mean, I could not believe
I was
that.
Surprised Rudy Giuliani wasn't put in that position as Attorney General. That's what I expected.
I think Giuliani right now is too, what's the word? He's too hot for this now.
Really?
Yeah, I think he's been doing a lot of bad things, and he doesn't have the support right now to do. And plus, I think Trump is saving him for another position.
Okay, all right. Yeah, you know, in that vein, still, the Paul Street article goes on to say, here in Iowa City, establishment Democrats are busy adapting to the new age of Trump they help create. They are focusing on their personal well-being is what they're doing. It was a stressful election, but life goes on, and it's not that really that bad, according to them. Not for them, anyway. Trump isn't going to take away their law practices, their tenured academic positions, their college football tailgate sports spots, their administrative posts, their comfortable pensions, their European vacations, their sumptuous homes, or their nice cars. The main price will be paid by less privileged, less white, and more vulnerable people, Latinos, Muslims, immigrants, African Americans, Native Americans, women seeking control of their bodies and lives, not to mention livable ecology and the working class as a whole. Oh, it's a shame that all that, but everybody really just, you know, should have voted for Hillary. It was her turn. Time to get behind the peaceful transition of power and start working to get out the vote in 2020. Of course they don't care. Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report recently told me the Democratic, according to her quote, the Democratic Party is a PR firm that specializes in convincing people that the party, the Democratic Party, works for their interests when they don't.
Exactly.
All they want is to win the presidency and cut deals with rich people. Mm-hmm. This year they couldn't even do that.
Exactly. I mean, the case in point is this: any attempt to present the Democratic Party, that's the new name should be, the Democratic Party of Wall Street.
Yeah,
that's the act.
That's
the name. That's what it should be.
Yeah,
and to present, you know, and they're in this big military industrial complex now. As any attempt to push them as progressives and serving the interests of working people is a complete fraudulent line.
Yes.
We can no longer, that cannot be any more discourse now for us at all. As workers, as working people, as anybody that is part of the working or poor classes, no longer. The most basic and critical lesson of the Trump election and the Democrats basically just cowing to him is the urgent need for working class people and the youth to have a complete break from the Democratic Party and take the road of independent political struggle against capitalism and against the political system. We have to have a clean break. And there was a chance for that. I'm telling you. And I don't believe in vanguardism.
Yeah.
But I believe that there would have been something if Sanders had said, if when he lost, because of the fraudulent way he lost, if I'm going to run independent.
Yeah.
Because you all stole the primary from me, that would have led. I'm not pushing vanguardism,
yeah.
But there was something in the hearts of people.
Oh,
even though I had a big problem with his analysis of capital and his foreign policy and race. But there was still something that would have that led to bigger discussions, though, that would have led to more mobilizing of people that could have broken the political system.
Yes. But you saw what lengths they went to prevent Sanders from getting elected.
But
election fraud, voter disenfranchisement. The corporate Democrats would rather have a Republican like Trump win than to have a Bernie Sanders or someone even farther on the political spectrum to the left than he.
But again.
Because it's a corporate agenda that matters.
And this is why C.L.R. James is so important. When I talk about vanguardism and what he wrote in Black Jacobins, because when you look at who Sanders is, the thing that drives people the most, and this is from Sundi Adachajua, is ideology.
Yes.
Sanders was never going to be that person that breaks away and says, I'm independent, I'm going to build something.
Yeah.
He was never, that's not his ideology. His ideology is to reform the Democratic Party so that he can garner popularity to run in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty much the goal of the, because they lost so many young voters, right? And because Trump is now, and nobody voting, young people didn't vote for Trump either. Now you have this thing where the Democratic Party is pushing reform the party now to bring the young voters in to get Sanders in 2020. That's the plan now. And they're clear on that.
Yeah, and even with that, I mean, the corporate Democrats aren't even, you know, they're going to keep doing what they've always done. That is defeat progressive populist Democrats in primary after primary. I mean, that's what Rahm Emanuel used to do up in the Chicago suburbs, was to make sure progressive populist Democrats would win the Democratic primaries.
That's right.
And they want, the corporate agenda is all that matters to them, basically, because it enriches them.
And
they don't want any kind of, progressive leftist policies that would help working people in general.
And that's why we have to really pay attention to what Sanders is going to be saying these next 4 years, because I guarantee you, by the time we get to 2019, you're going to not hear as much of his he was never anti-capitalist, but his anti-corporate talk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, there's going to be a change, because they're going to meet with him and they're going to tell him, we're going to get you the presidency, but you cannot attack us as Wall Street. And that's why I'm saying, that's because who, that's his ideology. He's willing to change and mold himself to get to a particular point. And we saw that during the campaign. We saw him change his rhetoric on a lot of things. So Sanders is moldable for the capitalist class.
Yeah.
And we have to recognize that.
That's I don't doubt that a bit.
Yeah,
I don't doubt that a bit, Gus. I can see that clearly happening. But I mean, if this goes through, I mean, with all this, the agenda of Trump, which it seems like it will, because like we can pretty much tell what the policies of the president are going to be by his cabinet appointees, there is going to be such turmoil and pushback amongst the people that this country is going to descend into chaos.
It's actually interesting. It's actually interesting because his transition team is reportedly almost at fisticuffs over his appointments because he's picking people. The Bannon one, and I think the guy the national security advisor he chose.
Not Clapper.
Starts with an F.
Fink. Is it Fink?
Flynn. Yeah, that was those two were the ones that led to internal issues, and that there's actually they've actually had heated arguments amongst his transition team, and I think that's why Christie and Giuliani haven't been put on yet, because I think that they were like, whoa, I don't know about this, and Trump was like, well, y'all out then. I think that's what's happening right now. So you got this turmoil going on because he's really trying to turn a lot of people. Again, that's the thing about this country and the politicians. These people are capitalists, and they are about exploitation. They like to neglect black and brown people. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about fascist policies, there are certain things that they don't want to go to.
Yeah.
And they see that Trump is building his group along fascist lines, and some of them are even coming out internally telling him that this is going to go bad. You shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's happening internally. And we're starting to understand that this is a fascist regime that's building. And people shouldn't be afraid to compare him to Adolf Hitler. I mean, I don't understand why people are afraid to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very accurate representation based on his campaign rhetoric, based on his cabinet selections, and based on his 100-day plan.
Yeah.
It's very similar.
Mussolini. I mean, the only difference I would differ on that crack article about, comparing Trump to Hitler, is that we don't have, and hopefully it won't come to that, but, right now where we're at economically, it's bad, but it wasn't nearly as bad as what it was in Weimar Germany, before Hindenburg appointed Hitler as chancellor. And then the Nazi Party eventually,
But you did have a ruling class that did have some money there.
Oh yes,
it was depression here, but of course we're still reeling from the Great Recession of 2008, mm-hmm. and then the forecast is saying that we're going to have a smaller recession either next year or the beginning of next year or the middle of next year. So something is on the pipelines for that. So again, I mean.
But we got to remember, that's funny because there's all sorts of revisionist history, as you well know.
Of course.
And I saw a recent exchange between Bruce Dixon, the Black Agenda Report, and some guy, I can't remember his name, who used to be part of the Clinton administration, now supposedly such a great progressive, like Robert Reich, basically trying to say that the ruling class didn't support Hitler. It's like, are you kidding me? There's a great book by an author named Poole called Hitler's Secret Partners that documents that the industrialists, German industrialists, and even rich capitalists here in the United States, the Bushes and other people, pillars of American capitalist society supported the Nazi Party early on.
He was so supported that he was doing interviews with everybody. He was on. He was in Business Week. He was in Time.
Yes.
I mean, the ruling class from multiple countries loved Hitler.
Yes.
Those first 3 to 4 years. Oh, he was so popular across the world.
Yeah, especially in this country, especially the upper echelons of the military officer class and the country club set. They love, because remember one of the classics. You see some more. I don't know where I got this, but I remember hearing this since I was a little kid about how a lot of these people would justify Hitler in the early years, saying, "Well, at least he makes the trains run on time.
Yeah,
at least he got the unions to heal." Well, yeah, he destroyed them completely. Yeah. And we got to understand, too, though, what's kind of scary, though, here, Gus, is that when Hitler started coming to power, you had two, not one, but two, actually three, if you want to kind of, stretch a little bit, opposition parties in Germany. Besides the conservative /Nazi party, you had the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and
little bit of a stretch to liberals.
And what was the first group that he completely destroyed?
He went after the communists first, because they had guns. Exactly. You know, they fought back the street thugs of the Nazis.
He realized that too, because when he was doing his stuff, let's not forget now Hitler was involved in some underground like criminal activity himself when he was younger. Yeah. And so he understood that the Communist Party, they had power and they had guns and stuff. So the first thing he did when he got into power is that he took care of the really extreme anti-Jewish people and put them in jail to garner popularity. Then he put out a whole bunch of nasty propaganda against the communists, and so he made the people feel like we have to get rid of the communists.
And what sparked that was the Reichstag fire.
Exactly.
Where basically they set the German parliament on fire and then basically blamed a mentally retarded Dutch immigrant that supposedly was a member of the Communist Party, and in record time tried him and executed him.
Exactly.
You know,
and then went in and just totally dismantled the Communist Party in the state.
And then the socialists were next, because they didn't have guns necessarily, very rarely, but they had a huge media network, radio stations, newspapers, you know, and the support of the majority of the trade unions, mm-hmm. you know,
that's
which
right.
by going after the socialists, they simultaneously went after the trade unions. Mm-hmm. And they still kept, basically destroyed all the independent trade unions, but they recreated the German labor bund, you
exactly.
know, which basically was a government-controlled labor federation that make our corporate unions probably look democratic.
Of course. And all this was done under the same thing that Trump is doing now, is saying that this is something that is going to protect and help the country get stronger. This is going to go against the establishment that has hurt the working people for so long. We have to get rid of these groups to make our country better.
Yeah.
It's the same discourse that's
sure.
being used.
Yeah. I think it's going to fail. I hope it fails. Let's put it that way. But I think there's going to be such incredible pushback on this I don't know what to expect, Gus. I mean, it's going to be strange.
I believe in the will of the people, though.
Yes.
I believe that because there is so much militancy, particularly in labor, particularly because of what's been going on with a lot of the racial oppression now, that there is going to have there is a class identity that is developing. I don't know if it's necessarily going to be very sophisticated in that. Is going to understand the different levels of class oppression, class warfare, but there is something brewing that is going to understand that the federal government in its current state does not have the interests of the people. And I think that's important to recognize that's something that is going to build.
Indeed. Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on radio station WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, 104.5 FM, and webcast live worldwide at WRFU.net. And stay tuned, and we'll be right back real soon here.
There is a war going on for your mind. Media mavens mount surgical strikes from trapper keeper collages and online magazine racks. Cover girl cutouts throw up pop-up ads infecting victims with silicone shrapnel. Worldwide passenger pigeons deployed paratroopers. Now it's raining pornography. Lovers take shelter. Post-production debutantes pursue you in NASCAR chariots. They construct ransom letters from biblical passages and bleed mascara into the holy water supplies. There is a war going on for your mind. Industry insiders slaying test tube babies to corporate crackheads.
Okay, we're back. WRFU, listen to the World Labor Hour. And who do I have on the phone today?
It's Sean here.
Yes, this is Sean O'Terrain, the author of the book The Donegal Woman. Welcome to the World Labor Hour. So I guess we can start out. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about your background?
In the form of why I wrote the book.
Okay.
That would be a better way to explain it, I think. As some of your listeners mightn't be surprised to know, I'm a socialist, and I read some of the socialist works when I was young, and one of the things that struck me was that there seemed to be an insufficient attention to the special oppression of women.
Uh-huh.
I was brought up in Ireland, in rural Ireland, in a small family farm where the woman lived in drudgery and did a lot of work. And I used to observe that and wonder why that was so. Also, the woman at that time had no reproductive facilities, never mind rights. There was no contraception. It was illegal, and so on. And it used to make me think about why this was. Why were women specially oppressed? But also, why did the socialist movement and the left movement not pay more attention to that? Like, if we read Marx, Marx writes, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. Well, that's not actually accurate. It should be from each according to his and her ability, to each according to his and her need.
Yes.
He was a genius. I learned so much from him, but still was a sign of a certain lack of thought about the special oppression of women. So that made me think about trying to do something about it. Then my mother told me, she was a peasant woman, she told me about her mother, my grandmother. I never met her, and her life, which was very difficult. And then when I got older, I began to think about my grandmother's life and decided to write this book as a contribution to helping people become more conscious of how life was very difficult, and more difficult for especially working class and poor women.
So this was a form of kind of indentured servitude, if not a form of slavery, to where poor people would sell their children into bondage, so to speak?
Well, you had very bad land, rocky, bad land, and then you had better land in a different part of the country. Now, the people in the very bad land, they really could not feed their children because of the they were living on basically rocks. And so what would happen is, when their children would grow up, the farmers in the better land, they would need more labor, so they would, what they called, hire them out to work for them, and they would go and live in the with the rich farmer, the better off farmer. And they had this system called the hiring fair system, where you would go to a town, a farmer would come and look at you, see if they thought you were healthy enough, even in cases, famous cases of looking at your teeth, feeling your muscles, that kind of thing. And then they would hire you for 6 months, and you would go and live in their land, in their farm, for 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, if you had performed properly according to their judgment, then they paid you. During those 6 months, you got paid nothing.
Wow.
In many cases, you lived in their barn or their byre. In my grandmother's case, she lived in the barn of that family farmer. They had, of course, enormous power over her. They didn't have to pay her for 6 months. They controlled the roof over her head. She had no power.
Yes, and there was also cases of sexual abuse, too, wasn't there, amongst the female laborers?
Well, my grandmother was raped by that farmer, and I had to imagine that when I was writing the book. She was only about 12 or 13. She would have had no sexual education whatsoever. He raped her repeatedly. She became pregnant, and then the local middle-class religious organization, which she belonged to and her family belonged to, which is a Protestant organization, they had to try and hide the shame, as they would have seen it. So they organized her to be married off to my grandfather, and he was given money to take her, and that's who my grandfather is. And my grandmother then had a baby, had some other babies with my grandfather.
Okay, so, you know, it's interesting, too, is that I think the story behind your self-publishing, self-promotion of the Donegal Woman is an interesting story as well. Remember that you had you couldn't get it published here in the United States, and you had to actually go to the Republic of Ireland and the U.K.?
Yes. I used to be a full-time organizer for a socialist organization, and I got fired from that because I wouldn't go along with their nonsense, not their socialist nonsense that I still believe in, but their interpretation of that. So I became a mover of furniture with a pickup truck, and in between my jobs, I started to write the book as a tribute to my grandmother and also to my mother, who loved and respected my grandmother. And so I had the basic outline of my grandmother's story, which was which is what I basically told you, but I had to imagine other aspects of it as well, and so I wrote the book. Now, I had no idea how this book would go, as I still haven't got it published in America. They won't publish it. But in Ireland, two friends of mine helped me. We set up a bank account, and I wrote the book, and they helped me go through it a bit. Two old friends from the left-wing movement in Ireland, and we wrote the book. Now, the printer said, print about at most 600 copies. They'll be lying under your bed when you die. Now, the book sold 28,000 copies.
And that was basically through, like, an informal network, wasn't it? Like, through gas stations and other places?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we went to, you know, it's like you would say in politics, in a way, having an orientation to the working class. We went to the local grocery store, the local gas station, any outlet that sold anything in the neighborhood, that part of Ireland where the book was about. We also went to the big bookshops in Ireland, and for a while they took them and sold massive amounts. But after a while, if you don't sell huge amounts, they don't take them anymore. They won't make enough money. But it still sells away to this day. And the it sold through that network of why it was such a success also was, at that time, about 10 years ago, there was an explosion in Ireland of the sexual abuse that had been going on by the Catholic Church hierarchy, the priests and the bishops, and also just in general. And that just exploded to the surface, and people wouldn't let it be hidden anymore. And by complete coincidence, well, maybe it wasn't, but it was pretty much of a coincidence, my book, The Donegal Woman, came out at that time. And people were discussing this, and people were talking about this issue. And then the book struck a chord. Like, I was in a grocery store one day, and I was asking the man behind the counter, did he need more copies? And he said, yes, I do. But a lady behind me in the line, she said to me, she said, did you write that book? And I said, yes. She said, well, thank you, because that was every woman's story back then. And so it struck that chord, because there was that issue coming up. The other... I'm trying to get it international now. I've got some people to help me, and we're put it now as an e-book form, and it's on Amazon. And the reason is because, well, I would do it one way or another, but it's very important, I believe, that now we have a transformation of the gender composition of the working class in the world. 50% of the world's factory workers are now women. That's a staggering change, and that's before China moves and the Chinese woman workers move. Also, it might have, your listeners might have noticed and September the 2nd in India, between 160 and 180 million workers went on strike, the biggest general strike in history.
Yes.
And amongst those was tens and tens of thousands of women workers. And so there's a lady down in Mexico who wants to translate my book into Spanish as well. So this is an issue that I believe this book will help people's consciousness. I don't want to be arrogant or anything, but will help people think about their world. And like what I try and do in the book is, my grandfather was an agent for the local landlord. His job was to collect the rents from the tenants and also to keep the tenants in line, to keep them in the plot of land that they rented. So he was middle, you couldn't say middle class, but that was his job. And he had to do that, he had to use force and be firm, as he would have seen it.
This was almost like a feudal-like system, almost.
Oh, yeah, it was, at that time. Yeah. But to do that, he needed to develop qualities, if you can call them that. That is, he had to be able to physically defend himself against tenants. There was one famous occasion, my family always told me, that he was severely beaten up by tenants because he was trying to get the rent out of them. And also he was an informer to the landlord and would tell him, the landlord, what was going on and so on. And so his world and his psychology was one in which he thought was important to keep control of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mother came along, or my grandmother, rather, came along. And she came into his world. And so he had to keep control, the way he saw it was, he had to keep control of her too. And so it was easy to do that at the beginning, because she came from being abused, beaten up, sexually abused, and she didn't know really anything about the world, her life, her body, anything, how things worked. And she was almost broken initially by that. But then she had her first baby, and when she found her first baby on her stomach, now I have to imagine this bit, but then she gets new thoughts and new feelings and new hope. And then instead of living the previous years of her life where she just wanted to die, her life was so miserable, she then wanted to live for her children, and she got new hope, new thoughts, new optimism. But then that came into conflict with my grandfather, because what he did, he then saw her getting, as he would have said back Ireland at those times, getting above herself. What was she talking out for? What was she speaking up about? He was the boss. Why didn't she just know her place? And for a period of time, she didn't speak at all. Literally did not speak. Because that brought her into conflict with him and the world around her. But one day, she realized that if she didn't speak, her children would not speak. They could not learn how to speak. So one day, she blurted out some words to him. And he was astounded, and he hit her and tried to stop her, but she protected her baby that she was holding at that time and prevented it from being injured and held on and spoke out. Then the next step she took was she began to sell the eggs from the hens to the local shop and buy little goodies like cookies and so on for the children. And he tried to stop her do that, but she wouldn't let him. And one day she said to him, "I'm selling the eggs." And he was so shocked that he didn't manage to recover himself sufficiently, so she made another breakthrough Now she was speaking. Now she was selling the eggs. Now she was getting little goodies for the children. And her world began to expand. Then she began to do things like things of beauty. There was a lake close by where they lived, and she would take the children there to see the lake, to paddle on the lake. One day they saw a salmon jump. And this was widening her own and her children's outlook on the world and in life.
You know, Sean, this book sounds like it's has quite a political metaphor to it. I mean, it's, I know it's about one woman's story of you know, abuse and stuff, but I mean, I can't help but think about this in political terms too. I mean, as far as the general society as a whole, you know, in the world, as far as working people,
it's completely political.
Yes,
I with my history, thought it wasn't political enough, but. But it's not the case. I'll give you an idea how political it is. My relatives in Ireland, with one exception, are all right-wing Protestant pro-British people.
Mm-hmm.
With one exception, who I have remained very good friends with over the years, by I don't know how, but I have. With one that exception, they all hate this book.
I bet.
Yeah, because it's because they know it's political.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, if you ask them, like you are doing, asking me now, they wouldn't really be able to say why they know it's political, but they know it's political.
Yes.
They know they would be more inclined to say, it's getting at us, because that's the way they would see it. But it's because it's political because the struggle of a young, poor background woman who fights against her environment, overcomes it, and goes on to expand her horizons, help her children, expand her children's horizons. It's a struggle against capitalism, but she doesn't know the word even.
Yes.
That doesn't mean it's not a struggle against capitalism.
Indeed. Sean, where can people find your book? I mean, you mentioned Amazon. Is it available on Amazon currently?
Yeah, if you go on the internet and go to www.thedonegalwoman.com, that will bring up all the reviews, and there are very good reviews there. Like one lady wrote on that she read it four times.
Wow.
Another lady wrote on that it had changed her life and thanked me. So you get it there. If you want to Google the English version of my name, which is John Throne, J-O-H-N, and the second name is Throne, T-H-R-O-N-E. If you Google that, that will bring up the book also, but it will also bring up interviews with myself about the book, and also interviews about myself where I took part in the uprising in the city of Derry in 1969, where working class people in the Bogside and Craigan took over the city, took over those parts of the city, and ran it for a period of time under their own control. So,
yeah, Sean, I was going to say we just about went out of time, but I definitely want to get you back on the show sometime in the near future to talk about that story in depth about the Battle of the Bogside.
That would be good, yes. That would be very good.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling in. And again, this is Sean O'Terrain, the author of the book, The Donegal Woman. Thanks for calling in, Sean.
Thank you for having me on. Dave.
My pleasure.
Somewhere between prayer and revolution, between Jesus and Huey P. Newton, that's where you find Johnny Five shooting water guns at the audience while you're scooting. Your booty is maxed due to the fact that he's tooting on the horn. Gonna warn you that I'm rooting for the other team in the culture war, so I stab the beast belly as the vulture snores. Yo, yo, let it blow with convulsive force. The walls fall off their false supports till Jericho's aircraft carriers alter course, and all brave young Americans are called ashore, 'cause we've already lost the war. They keep waging raging, splattering the streets in battles that keep raging, bloody in each page, and the stories that we're studying each day the same, just the names keep changing,
saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been all over the globe on our government funds, leaving man, woman, and child dead, bloody and numb.
Saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been overthrowing leaders with legitimate views, democratically elected, but we didn't approve.
How many times can the line divide? How many wars to uphold your pride? These fears uncontrolled just roll the tide. A blood in the streets while the people die. I'ma keep on trying. Long as suffering is multiplying. And why not? These souls getting tossed and left out. I ride my back's broad enough to help lift your cross. As long as you help with mine, the process of healing will take some time. To see the pain in your face is the same as mine. It's not a game or a race, but the stakes is high. We maintain our mistakes for the sake of size. As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time. As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time. As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time.
The same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been all over the globe on our government funds, leaving man, woman, and child dead, bloody and numb.
Saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been overthrowing leaders with legitimate views, democratically elected, but we didn't approve.
Same thing.
U.S. is not
same
us.
Same thing.
And us is not we.
Same thing.
And we are not satisfied.
Same thing.
We're tired of the same thing.
Same thing.
And we're ready to make change.
Same thing.
Are we ready to make change? We want money for healthcare and public welfare.
Free Mumia
and Leonard Peltier. Human needs, not corporate greed. Drop the debt
and legalize weed.
We say yes to grassroots organization. No to neoliberal globalization. Bring the troops back to the USA
and shut down Guantanamo Bay.
Who let him overthrow Jacobo Arbenz? Who let him overthrow Mohammed Mossadegh? Who let him assassinate Salvador Allende?
I didn't let him, but they did it anyway.
Who let him overthrow Kwame Nkrumah? Who let him overthrow Aristide? Who let him assassinate Oscar Romero?
I didn't let him, but they did it indeed.
But don't let them assassinate Hugo Chavez. Don't let them assassinate Evo Morales. And bring back Martin, Malcolm, Medgar, Hampton, Turner.
Same things over again.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, broadcasting at 104.5 FM and at WRFU.net worldwide. Been some stuff, interesting stuff happening around the world. There's been, a lot of violent clashes of protesters and police in Brazil over the new right-wing government after they impeached the president, and they're starting to, the authorities, the police, the military are starting to go after certain community groups like the Organization of Landless Peasants, and now it seems like the trade unions are now under attack, so I guess there's been a lot of fighting back on that. President Obama went to Greece here just recently, and when he landed, instead of getting a huge friendly welcome, I guess there was a huge violent protest in which the riot police had to be called out. I mean, it got pretty tense, and it's funny because he said that Greece hopes Obama will be able to persuade its foreign creditors to restructure some of its debt, which stands at nearly 180% of its national output. Earlier, Mr. Obama had delighted his Greece hosts by supporting debt relief for the recession-battered economy, which has seen its economy shrink by a quarter in just 7 years. But it's interesting, I guess the Greek people blame the United States for a lot of their problems through the European Troika because of most of the major banks like Goldman and financial investment houses like Goldman Sachs are the ones responsible for the toxic debt that caused Greece to go into its economic problems. And what's interesting is that President Obama's visit comes only 2 days before the anniversary of a bloody 1973 student revolt in Greece that helped topple the 1967-74 military junta, military government, which was backed by the U.S. government. And anyway, I guess that's going on in Korea. Up to 1 million workers and citizens rallied in the capital of Seoul
On November 12th, demand immediate resignation of President Park Geun-hye. Over 150,000 trade unionists also held a workers' rally organized by the National Center, the KCTU, which is the Korean Labor Federation, to highlight demands for the release of all imprisoned trade unionists and an end to the ongoing attacks on democratic rights and workers and their trade unions. And a delegation of international European U.S. trade union representatives joined the demonstration and rallies. That's been going on around the world. I guess Honeywell, the corporation Honeywell, is using its corporate power and wealth here in the United States to punish working families in South Bend, Indiana, and Green Island, New York. Honeywell locked out hundreds of UAW Local 9 and Local 1508 workers in May after the workers voted to reject the latest company concession demands on a new labor contract. The union had agreed to keep working while negotiations continue, but the company locked them, locked them out at a time of record profits for Honeywell. And I guess at the same time, they were bringing in replacement workers and expecting the UAW workers to train these workers. I mean, are you kidding me? That's been going on. And also, I guess air maintenance workers at United Parcel Service has voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike against the world's largest package delivery company as contract talks remain deadlocked over health care benefits, the workers' union said on Monday. And I guess Teamsters Local 2727 said 98% of those who took part in a mail-in ballot voted to authorize strike action. That's pretty high. Mm-hmm. 80% of the local's 1,200 members participated in the ballot. Contract talks have been going on for 3 years. If they remain deadlocked Monday, union representatives said they'll begin the process that could lead to a strike within 60 days. Unbelievable. 3 years they've been in negotiation.
Yep.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. The last, I think one of the last great workers, of the leaders of the Teamsters Union was Kerry. And, you know, that's an interesting story we got to talk about sometime on here, is how he was led the successful UPS strike that happened back in the 90s. And after that, I mean, it was like the labor movement, after being beaten down for so long, saw a major, major victory in this UPS strike victory. And then it turns out, I guess, his next project after that was to basically challenge the NAFTA agreement by having the Teamsters on the U.S.-Mexican border demonstrating and challenging the NAFTA agreement that would allow substandard Mexican trucks to come into the United States, and basically where the Mexican truck drivers weren't subject to the same U.S. laws on conditions as far as only being allowed to drive so many hours without a break and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
And it was that point that the U.S. government trumped up phony charges against him and basically caused him to be ousted as the president through legal action, and he can't hold union office again, even though he was not convicted on a single charge. Mm-hmm. It was all trumped up charges. It was government repression. And of course, we've seen what's happened after that. You had Jimmy Hoffa just recently narrowly won a re-election bid. It was real close, but it's too bad, because there's somebody that definitely needs to be replaced.
Exactly.
But we've got a little time here still, Gus, and I guess we could just keep talking about the U.S. elections or anything else you see that we need to be talking about here. Because it's really starting to entering some very turbulent, interesting times here, and I think we need to be prepared as best we can. And in order to do that, we need to analyze what happened and who's to blame, I think.
Well, one thing that we haven't done is the jobs report.
Oh, jobs report, of course. Yes, please.
You know, the jobs report is something that, again, has been overshadowed repeatedly because of elections.
Yes, yes. It's overshadowed a lot of things. Yeah.
I've only seen it maybe in two different places in the corporate media, at the bottom of the page somewhere. But the report is not going very well in terms of there's a lot of stagnation happening right now. So the report released in October, or excuse me, the report released for October's job report by the Labor Department provide a snapshot of the economy that shows that stagnation is really the central, is what's happening now with the economy. The net non-farm payroll increase was a tepid 161,000, with the bulk of the new jobs, as in previous months, made up of low wage, service, and part-time positions. So again, listeners, you've been listening to this show now for over a year. You've noticed that every jobs report that has come out that we reported on has shown that most of the new jobs that are being created of this hundreds of thousands of jobs are always low wage, service, and part-time positions. So you have a lot of temp agencies now that are running
employment right now for the U.S. A lot more working class people are no longer able to have livable wage jobs, so they have to go and get these part-time, low-wage service jobs. A lot of them usually don't come with benefits, and a lot of them come with layoffs after a short period of time.
Yeah.
Economists have predicted a payroll increase of 173,000, even with a combined upward revision of 44,000 jobs for the months of August and September. The overall rate of job creation has slowed markedly, averaging 181,000 a month through October as compared to 229,000 for all of 2015. And again, that 181,000 a month average, most of those jobs that are, and I'm not talking about like 60-40, I'm talking 80-20. 80% of those jobs that are being created are low wage jobs.
80%.
Yeah, the number of long term unemployed remain at 2 million, comprising 25.2% of those officially counted in the government tally. So these are really high numbers for the seventh year of the Obama calls his recovery. The decline in the official unemployment rate to 4.9% in October from 5.0% in September was not the result of workers joining the labor force and finding jobs. And that's what the corporate media and that's what the Obama administration is telling us, that all this is happening because workers are getting hired and joining the labor force. It's not true. This comes from the departure of 425,000 more working Americans, bringing the number of such workers who are outside the labor force to a near record high of 94.6 million people.
Wow.
So again, for those listening, the reason why the unemployment rate dropped from 5.0 in September to 4.9% in October is that it is a departure of 425,000 more working age Americans who are bringing the number of workers who are outside the labor force to a near record high of 94.6 million people. So these are people who are not part of the labor force or the legal labor force.
Yes,
the
underground economy.
Yeah, the underground economy is growing, and people are not recognizing that. That is an important part of understanding class structure and class warfare, that these people who are engaging in illegal capitalism are not part of any class. As Marx argues, they are declassed. That's what the lumping group is that they are no longer part of a class. And a lot of this has to do with the way the political economy is structured. A lot of these jobs that are coming out, these low-wage service jobs and part-time positions, they are not enough to counter cost of living. They are not allowed. I mean, I can do a whole show on the idea of cost of living versus minimum wage and all that. I mean, these numbers show that people, for lack of a better term, cannot maintain a regular lifestyle off of the way that wages are set up at this current moment, the way jobs are set up at this current moment. So just a couple more numbers. The labor force participation rate declined, reaching 62.8% in October versus 62.9% the prior month. And this is something that, if you've been listening to the show, has continued to decline, is the labor force participation rate. Manufacturing employment declined for the third straight month with a net loss of 9,000 jobs. And manufacturing is usually the ones that have working class wages, to where Yes. You can actually maintain a family and possibly create a savings, possibly, not definitely. And so those jobs are continuing to go. Now, mining continues to lose jobs, which is fine as long as they replace those jobs, because mining jobs are horrible for the environment. Mm-hmm. But the political economy is not replacing mining jobs with anything else. So people are just being laid off from mining and there's nothing else that's going on. So a particular telling indicator of the deterioration in the social and economic position of the working classes in this country since 2008 is the wholesale destruction of decent paying full-time jobs and the replacement by part-time, contingent, and temporary positions. The corporate elite operating through the Obama administration, and that's important to understand, political and economy must be put together. They are not separate. The political drives the economy. That's very important. The corporate elite operating through the Obama administration has carried out a far-reaching restructuring of social and economic relations to reduce the living standards and increase the exploitation of workers. And these jobs reports are clear indications of that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just look at the numbers every month that they come out, And, of course, they only talk about two numbers. They only talk about the unemployment rate, and they only talk about the number of jobs created.
You know, that's what I love about you doing this as a regular feature, Gus, is because, you know, that this really goes to the heart of the matter. Where that's why they only do those two indicators, is that it's that way it's deceptive as far as what's really going on.
And this is how we know how what's happening with the material conditions, the distribution of wealth and resources. This is where you get to the heart of the matter when you talk about workers wanting to join unions, workers dealing with debt, dealing with bankruptcy. All these things are tied directly to the job report that the corporate media and the federal government do not give the full report. You have to go and look at it to find all these numbers and showing that there are more and more people who are bottoming out in this economy. And a lot of it is legal, driven by the federal government and the state governments that allow these things to happen.
Yeah, I think this is going to get worse under Trump.
It's going to get much worse.
I mean, it was going to get worse under Hillary Clinton, but I mean, this is, of course, we know, Trump's the bad cop they're sending in now because we wouldn't accept their good cop, supposed good cop. And so here, this guy, they're coming in with the brass knuckles and the rubber hoses and stuff. So, that's how I like to look at it, because that's, I've seen this pattern. I don't know how many times over the years. It's interesting because I think, I don't know if you saw, it's like, there was an article that I found kind of interesting that was on the, I can't remember what site it was, but basically it's the myth of the reactionary white working class. And
I saw that.
It's it's like in the days following the victory of Donald Trump in the presidential election, the Democratic Party and the media, and that's important, the Democratic Party and the corporate media have attributed the results to the ignorance, backwardness, and inherent racism and sexism of the white working class. White, quote unquote. Why Trump won working class whites, read the headline of a Wednesday article in New York Times. Columnist Charles Blow wrote in Thursday's Times op-ed page, quote, "I can only assume that President Donald Trump will be a bigot. It is absolutely possible that America didn't elect him in spite of that, but because of it." The so-called, quote unquote, left press, what they mean is liberal press, has advanced the same racial narrative. The Nation's Monica Potts noted with hateful sarcasm, quote, "This election season has seen no shortage of tender, worried portraits of the white working class and its economic grievances." Potts explains Trump's victories in terms of identity, race, and gender. The working class in rural communities make more money than their poor neighbors, she writes. They think they should work harder. They think the people, their neighbors, immigrants, African Americans, inner cities, do not work hard. While they could be doing better and certainly struggling, it is their cultural identity that is important to this election. This wasn't about anguish. It was about identity. This identity-based presentation of Tuesday's election results as a false narrative exploded by the most basic analysis of data from the election, which he goes into, and shows that, this is all a myth that's being perpetuated to basically divide us, Yes, these kind of people do exist out there, but, they've always existed. But the really disturbing thing is that Trump is giving legitimacy to that small minority element out there, the white supremacist element.
Well, the thing is that the race part is definitely central to why Trump won. That's key. But the problem is that people think that it's only these backwards, rural, poor people,
yes,
poor white working class people that did this. No, there's data out there that shows that most of Trump's main supporters are from the middle class.
Yes.
And again, if you look,
just like the Nazis,
of course, and you look throughout history, when you look at the building of racial segregation, apartheid in cities like Chicago, in cities like Atlanta, in cities like Kevin Cruz's book White Flight, Arnold Hirsch's Making the Second Ghetto, all these books that demonstrate how the white middle classes, the elites, they're the ones with money. They're the ones that were always in bed with the business people, the white politicians, to construct racial barriers in these particular areas, and that they only use the white working class to exploit and kind of push this anti-black propaganda in these areas. So again, so always you hear these people talk about, yeah, it's these backwards hillbilly white people that don't like black. Blah, blah. No, that has never been the case. It's always been the ruling class white people that have pushed their racism and their capitalism through the white working class,
yes,
to create a social hierarchy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, I think, documents the early years, you know, how this was developed in his book, Black Reconstruction
which
in America.
Which is the most important thing ever, and I still don't understand how that book is not considered to be the masterpiece of masterpieces, because he says he says it right there in 1935, that the biggest issue in terms of what happens, why we couldn't build a successful working class revolution, is the psychological wage and psychological wage, and also the material wage that was built into the restructuring of the capitalist system following the end of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
That's important to recognize, is that not only do as a white person you feel that you're better than this black person, so you vote outside your class interest, but you also get better wages. You get small things like better bathrooms, better lunchrooms. I mean, there's so many different things that you get better material than the black person. So not only is it psychological, but it is material as well.
Yes.
So nobody ever talks about those things, you know? And that's so critical to understanding this division and why there can never be some. Because again, there are two or three times throughout U.S. history where there could have been a working class, across racial lines revolution. Bacon's Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Reconstruction period.
Yes.
I mean, and then also, too, it could have been something in the mid to late 60s as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, not as much as that Reconstruction period. That was the period when everybody was recognizing the horrors of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And then you actually had radical Republicans in Congress at that time who came from these places where they were oppressed as well, and they got in the government. They were like, we're not having that. There's something wrong here. And I'm not saying all the radical Republicans were leftists, but you did have a few in there that recognized that there's a problem with the way our political economy is running. And then you had, of course, freed people and white workers understanding that, man, this is we're getting screwed here.
Yeah, and you mentioned before about how the public school system in the South after the Civil War was actually originally came from the black freedom schools, and then but later it was basically just by default expanded to cover poor white children as well.
Exactly, it was a blueprint for how to have education. You know, nobody went to public school en masse before black people created freedom schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the big thing, because remember, white people, especially in the South, their children were working.
Yes.
You know, you had a choice. You go to school or you work. And most of them said, we need to make some money, because remember, in the South, you only had a few major plantation owners that had significant wealth.
Yes.
Right? You only had a few of those. Most of the other people in the middle class of that who were not the significant wealth owners, they may have had a farm or so.
Or a business in town or something.
Exactly. And then, of course, the majority of white workers at that time were poor in the South. So they actually were looking to be overseers. They were being hired on to work with slaves in the fields as well. They were doing all these things, et cetera. So they were not, there was no schooling available for them. So after the fall of slavery and sharecropping becomes the big Southern economic venture, you know, you had black people creating schools and churches and getting money. Also, Northern philanthropists, former abolitionists as well, sending money to create schools, colleges, public education mm-hmm. centers, etc. So that branched out into the white working class communities as well, because they understood that education was going to be a new means, since there were all these new jobs available, that we had to learn skills, etc. And that became a big part of the new Southern mystique of this idea of being educated now
mm-hmm.
versus just going strictly to work.
Yes.
And that came from the model that's set forth by free people.
Yeah. And the ruling class doesn't want a well-educated working class.
Of course not.
It's best interest.
Education is the enemy of capital.
Yes.
Plain and simple. If you have an analysis and a critique of your social conditions, then you will fight against them.
I mean, they want you educated just enough to actually, you know,
to be able to turn a lever.
To turn a lever or
rubber on a tire.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just enough to where they can exploit you and make money, but
exactly.
Not too much to where you start, you know, understanding how society works, how the economy works.
And that's why they went after Du Bois. You know, Du Bois was very adamant in having a critique of society, of social conditions. So that's why you had so many different white business elites supporting Booker T. Washington's model. You know, this idea of you can ignore the lynchings, ignore the racial violence, ignore the discrimination, the exploitation of wages, etc. As long as you're able to get a job,
then you're fine.
Yeah.
You know, but don't actually learn history or don't learn social, don't learn economics, don't understand social conditions and stuff. So that's why they went after Du Bois in his battle between when he was going against Booker T. Washington.
Okay. All right. This is something I thought, you know, last few minutes we have here, maybe we could discuss a little bit. It's basically leaked the email showed that the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, yeah. National President Randy Weingarten promised to act as an attack dog for Hillary Clinton against another union leader that endorsed Bernie Sanders in the primary. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is going to be the next president of the United States. I feel a wild urge to scrub my hands with steel wool and bleach after typing these words. My fingers feel filthy. Okay. If we want to avoid a similar nightmare in the future, we have to parse this election's lessons and figure out who is to blame. Not for cheap point scoring, or, you know, but to make sure we don't make the same mistakes again.
Yep.
And this means we have to talk about how American union leaders helped hand this race to Donald Trump. And he goes on to say, it wasn't on purpose, of course. It's no secret that a Trump presidency would be absolutely disastrous for labor. Union leaders wanted to prevent this, but their idea for how to do so wasn't any different from the rest of the Democratic Party corporate establishment, going all in for a quote-unquote centrist, quote-unquote safe candidate like Hillary Clinton at a time when the electorate, the American people, was hungry for someone who would shake up the political system and who spoke to the pain so many Americans felt. Labor leaders should have been in touch with this sentiment better than anyone. Their members, whether a school teacher in the big city or laid-off factory worker in the Rust Belt, have suffered immensely in the age of austerity. There were warning signs. Unions haven't released their own internal polling data, but Working America said in January that Trump's anti-free trade message was resonating in Ohio and Pennsylvania, states hit particularly hard by deindustrialization. On Election Day, exit polls varied wildly, but many showed union households voting for Clinton by either slim margins, CNN put it at 51%, or by nowhere near at large margins they did for Barack Obama in 2012. Mm-hmm. Rather than acting as clarion voices cutting through beltway static to insist on choosing a candidate who spoke to working class suffering and dissatisfaction with status quo, labor leaders echoed the myopic vision of the pundits who insisted it was, quote, her turn. The Democratic king and queen makers would do this as maddening, but not unsurprising. So your thoughts and comments on that, Gus?
That's the same thing I said about electoral politics, that I say with the labor, the union organizations, that they are both so corroded at the very core at this point that neither one of them can be the vanguard for any revolutionary consciousness or movement.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, the stuff that's been happening at least in the past 20 years with labor leadership, with union leadership, and how it's completely alienated its own rank and file members, going against their interests. I mean, turning unions into these corporate models now.
Yes.
Into these areas where they sell people candidates, they sell people ideas that are counter to the worker progress. I mean, that's really what's happening now, and it's everywhere, and it's festering, especially when you talk about the things that they were doing in the primaries. I mean, they were literally telling people, this is who we endorse, without even talking to their rank and file.
Yeah, or taking, you know, they should have had a poll done amongst their members. Now, some unions did that, you know.
The locals did, but not the national. And then and for else listening, when I'm talking about the labor leadership, I'm talking about the national leaders.
Yes.
The national leaders at this point.
The six-figure, the people in the mid-six-figure range, some of those mid-six-figure national labor leaders, some of their members only make no more than, you know, $15 an hour.
Yeah,
you know?
They need to be out. I mean, these leaders need to be ousted. They need to be gone.
Yeah.
They need to do it like they used to do, where the person who was actually in the rank and file is able to become president.
Yes.
Keep the same, and they're doing the same job they've always done.
Mm-hmm.
They're not getting some $500,000 a year salary. They've actually done the work, and they have the same wages, etc. They have an election the very next year. They get out. Now they have all these very strict rules to allow these labor leaders, these national leaders, to remain in power for years.
Yes.
Without having them voted it out. That's clearly not democracy. They're actually going against the very idea of why unions were established in the first place.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. The UE, the United Electrical Workers, is one union exception. They basically, their national president makes no more than the highest paid rank and file worker. They're a very militant and democratic union, and they endorse Bernie Sanders. They were
along with the West Coast Longshoremen, the ILWU, they were targeted back in the 1950s because they took a vote. They're basically at that time after the Red Scare started and the Cold War started that they passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which required anyone wanting to hold union office would have to take a loyalty oath and et cetera.
Yeah.
And the unions had to vote it in. Well, the AFL and the CIO tried to force this on all their affiliated unions. Man. And the UE and the ILWU basically had the members vote on it. They said, here you are. What do you think? They voted it down by a huge margin. They said, sorry, we're not doing it. Our members rejected. They said, well, you have to force them to do it. They said, no, that's, you know, anyway, they were attacked viciously. I mean, there was four other unions along with the ILWU and the UE in the late 40s, early 50s that refused to do this. And those four, there's six of them, four of them were basically driven out of existence.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to turn the subject away,
yeah.
but just a quick side note
yeah.
is that there's been talk about bringing back HUAC.
Really?
Yeah.
The Whoa. American
committees, and then they're targeting, using that as a funnel to target, of course, that they're saying they're going to use it for ISIS, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
They're really going to target any radical groups or any on the ground grassroots groups, et cetera. So there has been talk amongst the new federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say new federal government, I'm talking about the Trump administration
yeah.
about the possibility of bringing back an entity like HUAC and something like that. Because, you know, that's what Sessions' biggest thing is, that anybody that goes against what we're trying to do is un-American.
We're going to be coming into some very, yeah. very interesting times here, and it's not going to fly. This is not going to fly with the American people.
No,
I mean, there's going to be a lot of turmoil, I think, in the meantime, you know.
Yeah,
but there's no way the majority of the American public's going to go for this stuff.
Yeah, but back to what you were saying, though, in terms of the suppression of these labor groups, these militant labor groups.
Yes.
So, I mean, and then you see the results of that today.
Yes.
As you have, I mean, again, these are people that are actually handpicked by political parties or by corporate interests to go in and to go into a labor organization and run it.
Yes.
Like, they actually have, I mean, they've only been to business school, they have MBAs, they have all this stuff, but they've never actually done the work of the union. So, of course, you have these strangers, which is so crazy, because when you read union history and you read labor history, like, everybody knew each other like brothers and sisters.
Yes.
And when the person became the leader of that particular local or the national union, like, everybody knew everything about them.
Yeah, and they deserved to get that position.
And they deserved to get that. But now you're bringing in these new people who have these very shady histories. You don't know anything about them except what they present. They don't have a relationship to the rank and file, and they're only there and it's this suit and tie.
I don't know much about Randy Weingarten's background, but I do know some perfect examples of what you're talking about, Gus. Richard Trumka, he first came out, I mean, he became an organizer for the Mine Workers Union. He never spent a day in the mine as a worker.
Exactly.
He came right out of law school and went to work for that. Another example is Jimmy Hoffa Jr.
Yep.
Now, his father went through the ranks, and he was a bit of a mixed bag, but Jimmy Hoffa Jr., who's now, you know, just barely won re-election as a Teamsters national president, he also right out of law school.
Yep, right, you know.
And so this is the power. Andy Stern, I mean, I'm, you know, he never, as far as I know, he never worked as a custodian or, you know, any other like job that SEIU member does, you know.
Of course not.
You know.
Yeah, this stuff is everywhere now. So again, there's a very simple solution to this, but it's just that there has to, you know, that's the one thing I don't understand. What I do understand about why this hasn't happened yet. There hasn't been an internal rebellion.
I think it's coming. There's a lot of people.
Yes. Because when you think about cost versus benefit and having an internal rebellion, very little can happen in terms of, there may be some retaliation from the corporate interests, etc. But if you have a massive enough organization like the UAW and you have an internal rebellion to oust Dennis Williams, there's very little that the corporate interest can do if the rebellion is supported. If the majority of the rank and file support said rebellion,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, there's very little that they can do, and that's something that has to happen. And if it happens in one area, it can happen in others.
It'll be like a wildfire.
It's infectious.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
like,
indeed.
Yo, why didn't we think of this before? It's like I read comic books and there's a comic book called Old Man Logan that they're making into the movie about Wolverine, and it's set into an alternative universe
uh-huh.
where all of the evil supervillains got together one night and said,
why don't we just get together and kill all these superheroes? There's more of us than them. So it's a really, it's like kind of funny when you read it. They're like, why didn't we, and while they're killing all the X-Men, they're like, why didn't we think of this before? And they end up taking over the whole world.
Oh, wow.
In one night. You know, I'm just saying, like, it's just some things you're just like, yeah, this is, we can actually do this. We can actually take control of our union again and actually have support for our rank and file members. Let's just do it.
Yeah. And it needs to be done. You think about, I hate to use this analogy, but this was the corporate world. Do you think Richard Trumka would still be the president of the National AFL-CIO, failure after failure after failure for the working people in general and the union movement? I mean, right now, we're at, we used to be, like, prior to 1970s, mid-70s, it was the workforce was 30% unionized. Now it's about 13.
Yeah.
And that's only 7% in the private sector.
Exactly.
The only reason it's 13% is the vibrant union movement in the public sector.
That's true.
You know, and, you know, it's going to be basically going out of existence if something's not done. And I know rank and file members, a lot of them are angry about this whole thing of endorsing their national leaders, endorsing Hillary Clinton without a vote from the membership. They're angry about, it seems like every time there's some kind of labor struggle, labor loses constantly, loss after loss after loss, concession after concession after concession, and they're sick and tired of it, you know. Not to mention the devastation that's been caused from the so-called free trade, you know, corporate managed trade, of loss of good manufacturing jobs and stuff, you know, and not new comparable jobs created that pay well. I mean, then we get into health care and stuff. So, and these labor leaders, they're too busy wanting to go have tea at the White House or hobnob at cocktails with Republican and Democratic congressmen and senators, you know.
On the golf course.
On the golf courses, yeah. You know, and that's the problem. They earn too much money. They're done in the same class as the rank and file members. That's the problem.
They don't have the interests of their own members at heart.
Yes.
And that's something that can be easily
recognized
or figured out so you can get rid of them super early.
Yes.
I mean, that's something like, I mean, from the minute they take the position, they have to already start negotiating things for the rank and file, for their workers. It's like day one thing.
Yeah.
So you figure out within a couple of weeks whether this person serves your interests or not. And they can be ousted.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on radio station WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, broadcasting from downtown Urbana, Illinois at 104.5 FM and live worldwide at WRFU.net. And stay tuned at 2 o'clock. First of all, stay tuned for the Union Edge. And then at 2 o'clock, Neil Parthen Show, not another sports show. So until next week, take care and be safe and power to the people.